Hello, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast. We cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your co-host, Eric Mike Sterino, coming today from a cold but rather pleasant Durham, North Carolina. And as always, I'm joined with Juliet Liu up in Ithaca, New York. Juliet, how's it going?
Hey, Eric, we're buried in snow up here, and we're doing well.
Ugh. Weather, it's such an interesting topic. I don't know why I always go to weather right away. I could say something else. But before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, analysis, and also join in on the discussion, we would love to hear your voice on these issues. You can join us on our social media, on Twitter and on Facebook, at Belt and Road Pod.
Awesome. Today, we're going to be talking about debt relations on the Belt and Road, which is something that we've talked about a few times in our podcast, but in a new way. The rise of debt relations along the Belt and Road Initiative is perhaps one of the most prominent concerns raised by observers. Huge infrastructure projects in general are always complicated to finance, and the structure of that finance defines in many ways the power balance between lender and debtor. In this case of BRI projects, that's between oftentimes China's major national banks and the financial systems of the range of countries where China has projects. You know, we've talked about this many times, but it's rarely possible to see how these kind of complex financial relations play out on the ground in host countries. The question being, how does the structure of financing of a project matter for how the project implementers operate? And what does it mean for the material process of infrastructure construction in country when things don't proceed smoothly on the financial end? Here to talk to us today about one case of that along the Belt and Road is Kelly Chen. Kelly is a research assistant professor in the Division of Social Science and a junior fellow of the HKUST Jockey Club Institute for Advanced Study. It's such a mouthful, but it's a great institute. She received her PhD in geography from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2020, and her research focuses on the relationship between state and capital in the ongoing globalization of China's political economy. Dr. Chen's project currently examines how the Chinese government mobilizes offshoring of capital from afar by invoking the imaginatory geography of One Belt, One Road. So very relevant to what we do. Kelly, welcome to the Belt and Road podcast.
Hello, Julia and Eric.
So Kelly, your research revolved around the Trans-Laos Railway. Can you first just give us a little bit of a background on this project?
Yeah, sure. So the Trans-Laos Railway we're going to talk about today is part of the Kunming-Singapore Railway that constitutes BRI's central piece on the mainland Southeast Asia. It connects Laos' northern border town Botan to the capital city Vientiane through a total of 414-kilometer standard gauge track. Like most of the other BRI-branded projects, the railway's history actually predates the policy initiative. The Chinese government approached Laos to initiate negotiation for this project as early as 2010, and the two sides actually reached an agreement around that time. This first agreement allegedly sketched out a plan to develop the railway as a wholly funded and owned entity by China, and this triggered strong concerns from the Laos side for its perceived encroachment on the country's sovereignty. The first deal also was rumored to involve large amount of land concession along both sides of the railway, which further fueled the criticism of the project being just a vehicle for China's land grabbing. So these backlashes likely pressed the Lao government to reconsider the first railway deal in the early 2010s. And at the same time, China also completely pulled out from this deal due to domestic political issues. Basically, the key Chinese politician backing this specific project then, the railway minister Liu Zhijun, fell from grace during Xi administration's anti-corruption campaign. And following that event, China's Ministry of Railway was dismantled and reorganized into China Railway Corporation as a move to centralize power. So it was not until 2014, when these domestic power struggles were sorted out, that China went back to Laos to discuss potentials of the Trans-Laos Railway. And everything was started from scratch again for the second round of negotiation. So the Chinese side conducted a new feasibility study and price appraisal for the project, which pinned its price tag at around $6 billion. That was $1 billion less than the first appraisal. And this figure serves as a referral point for the two sides to work out a concrete financial plan a year later in 2015. This new agreement sets the railway to be developed through a 30-70% Lao-China joint venture. And part of the funding Lao is supposed to commit into the project was covered by a loan from China Export-Import Bank. So once these financial logistics were figured out, the railway entered a quick bidding tendering stage and then moved into implementation in 2016. The project today is actually very close to completion. Even the COVID didn't stop the construction to move forward according to schedule.
That's so interesting. And, you know, you and I have been working in Laos for many years, but I remember when it, you know, when the negotiations were first going on in 2010, people were thinking, well, I was thinking, you know, this will never happen. The negotiations are so crazy. And then you're right. As soon as they signed the deal and figured out the financing, it was like there were Chinese cranes driving down the roads into Laos. And it's just been incredibly fast. So backing up, you take on questions of sovereign debt and public debt in different ways than a lot of people do. Can you help us understand, you know, what does sovereign debt mean? What does public debt mean in this case? And how was kind of the funding for the train structured? Why did it raise some critique? And what were people's concerns versus how the two sides came together and decided how to fund the project?
Sure. This is a question I often get when I present this work to audience. And when I actually first show this work to my best friend, the question I got is, what is sovereign about sovereign debt?
Yeah.
Which kind of kills me. Because I'm also not a financial specialist, so I do struggle to explain the term. So the simplest definition is just the amount of money nation state borrow from others, and that's it. Now, like, why can a country borrow money from others? Because it has ability to repay. We can relate this to our individual experience. If you have a credit card, then every time you use it, you are borrowing money from bank. Then why does bank issue you credit card in the first place? That's because you present like income documents or other proofs of debt servicing ability to the bank when you apply for the credit card, right? So this works exactly the same for nation state. It earns income through means like taxation, which enable it to appear creditworthy in the eyes of potential lenders. I think it's worth clarifying a few concepts first. The public debt that you just mentioned is a slightly broader concept than sovereign debt, because it can also include sub-sovereign debts, which is the money borrowed by municipal governments. For instance, like the city of Detroit is now worldly famous for over-accumulating sub-sovereign debts. And then for sovereign debt alone, there's a difference between internal sovereign debt, which means the money nation state borrow from its domestic citizen, and the external sovereign debts, aka debt owned to foreign creditors. So BRI's sovereign debt controversy refers to external sovereign debt accumulated by southern countries hosting BRI projects. Am I clear on that?
Yeah, very much so. And so with taking these definitions in mind, how was the funding for the train structured? You know, how much debt to whom, what type of debt was it, how much equity, these types of things.
Now, down to the specific case of the Trans-Laos Railway, what sparked concerns of debt trap in this case is the loan Lao government took out from China Export-Import Bank to pay for the project. As I said earlier, the entire train project was priced at $6 billion, and Lao holds 30% share on it. So if you do a quick math, it is responsible to contribute around $750 million. And two-thirds of that amount was to be covered by the loan from China, the Export-Import Bank, which came down to around $450 million. And the rest, one-third of funding, is supposed to be allocated from Lao state budget directly. And what is less known to the public is that the one-third amount of state funding actually serve as the equity necessary to channel the Chinese credit over into the project. So basically, for the sake of banking prudence, the Exim Bank would not release the credit until the Lao government has injected the equity into the project as planned. So this is how the Lao side of finance works. And for the Chinese side, a 70% share is held through a consortium of state-owned enterprises headed by China Railway Corporation. So sometimes a lot of news articles, especially at the beginning of like 2015, when the financial arrangement of the railway start leaking out to public, these media would be arguing that by building the railway alone would bankrupt Laos, would pull the country into a sovereign debt crisis. But if you actually put the figure Laos borrowed from China, $450 million, against the total amount of external sovereign debt it owns right now, which is an astonishing $12.6 billion. This is just tiny, right? It only accounts for 4% of Laos' total sovereign debt.
So the argument was like they had like 8 credit cards out already, and then just taking one more credit card out wasn't that much. Is that the argument?
Yes.
Okay.
So just to get the numbers straight, because it's often still touted as that when we talk about Laos and debt and how it's a $6 billion railway, and then they often compare it to like Laos' GDP, which is, I don't know how much, but it isn't too much over $6 billion. Only about $450 million of that is actual external sovereign debt to China?
Yes, accrued for this project.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, so I think a lot of these talks about debt trap, or like prediction about future debt distress. And it's like as if coming from people who doesn't have much financial literacy.
It is interesting in general. I certainly commend so much of the, just because there's such a lack of transparency on the China side and sometimes on Belt and Road country side of the amount of debt that exists. But when there are these kind of data repositories of Chinese projects and how it's always like the stated, what was put on the MOU, basically, $6 billion for this train or $1 billion for this port. And like, it doesn't take into account when that money goes in, if that money ever goes in, when the project happens, cost overruns, cost underruns, reduction in size of the project. And so it just really makes those big numbers that you often see in Chinese projects be very tricky to go off of.
Mm-hmm.
So your work, it's based off of over a year of ethnographic field work on the ground in Laos that looked at all the different actors involved in the Trans-Laos Railway and the actual construction of the train. Who did you actually work with? How did you access them? Can you give a list of the main actors and sub-actors involved in the Trans-Laos Railway?
Yeah, sure. And I would like to correct you a little bit, because I think I work mainly with the Chinese actors involved in the railway, not so much with the Lao actors, because I am Chinese and I don't speak Laos myself. So there's, of course, a difficulty to access those actors.
Right.
Yeah. So basically, when I started out this research project about Trans-Laos Railway, I've never been to Laos. And my understanding about this project comes from newspaper only. And the minute when I land on the ground trying to pursue research as planned, like a very idealistic grad student, I found that it's just impossible because it looks so much like a concealed entity. I can't just go to the railway labor camp and knock on the company's door and be like, I want to interview you or whatsoever. So actually, after I went to Laos, I tried out a little bit and I gave up this train research project for a bit. I felt like it's impossible. So I started basing myself in diaspora associations in the city of Vientiane and doing participant observation there, thinking that maybe I should switch my dissertation topic to look at state diaspora relation as like more realistic given my access. But these diaspora associations are basically networked space. So I kept running into people who have this or that relationship with a train because it's a massive infrastructure project. There are people like hanging around town who supplies construction materials like stone and cement to the railway, and people who print posters for the railway, and people who sell air conditioners to the labor camp, etc., etc. So gradually, through exchange with them, I started to like get an understanding that everybody is frustrated by the delayed financial progress of Trans-Laos Railway. Basically, as I said, the one-third of Laos state funding to the railway is connected with the arrival of the Chinese credit. And due to Laos' poor fiscal capacities, that one-third state funding didn't arrive on time. So was the credit. So basically, after the financial agreement was sealed in 2015, the railway start living two lives with distinctive temporalities. One life is that it went through tendering, bidding, and roll into implementation. The other life is that the financial life was so slow and disrupted and unraveled as planned. So all these Chinese actors in town kept telling me what's going on with the financial progress and blah, blah. And that's how I sort of collect data for the financial part of the paper. And then I forge connection through this exchange with some actors on the railway that eventually enable my access into the railway labor camp, one of them. And I went there for a few times over a longitudinal period of time to observe what has changed on the railway labor camp due to the financial instability of the project. And then I get to interview some of the important actors on the railway camp and triangulate their information. And that's how I piece together the labor part of my research. So I think in the end, like, it's fortunate that I get to eventually do this research project that I don't have access at the beginning.
Yeah, and the two temporalities, I mean, the two pathways that the train was taking, the financial negotiations and then what was happening on the ground, I think this is super common, but you don't usually see someone who has actually been able to research both, which I just think is very badass. So you had this snapshot of both people in Vientiane who are wondering how the finances were working out, and then the laborers in the camps on the ground who are basically part of the like you said, there's a split in the two stories of the train, and the financial side is going really slowly, and then there's already laborers on the ground just busting through Lao hillsides and building tunnels at an incredible speed. So give us a quick snapshot of like how the project was actually contracted. I know you found really fascinating ways in which, even though the money wasn't there, companies were basically launching into action, and you were interviewing some of the laborers that are actually like building the railway on the ground. Talk about that disconnect a little bit more.
I want you to think of yourself like building a railway, a massive entity like that, and what would you do? So if you're faced with that kind of project, first thing you would do is chop the railway into pieces and then find contractors who would oversee construction up to the standard, right? So that's what happened. Once after the financial arrangement was set up in 2015, a joint venture company specifically designated for this project was established in Vientiane. And then they selected six Chinese state-owned enterprises, which are all branch companies of the shareholding SOEs on the railway. And they tasked these six companies as contractors for like six separate sessions of the railway. And these contractors, they are involved in selecting like who are the actual subcontractors to undertake the actual construction works on the ground. So it went through another layer of subcontracting. Basically, each section of the railway was further chopped into small pieces and then awarded out to builders. And then from there downward, there will be some further subcontracting, usually conducted in informal way. Because if you are working on a railway and the section you happen to be awarded is combined by bridge and tunnel, right? So a cost efficient way to do so is somebody would take all the tunnels and somebody would take all the bridges, then the equipment you brought in would maximize out its value. So there's informal subcontracting after these layers of formal subcontracting. And then the railway ends up having a huge amount of small contractors working together. And then like each of these small builders would bring in their labors on their own. And then I would say that most of the builders are like these small construction firms owned by private investors, which people refer to as 老板 on the railway. And these people are very cost sensitive. So in working out a labor recruitment strategy, most people turn to local labor first because it's much cheaper than, of course, bring in Chinese labor. So in a labor camp I did this in-depth research on, the Laoban first sourced low-skill labor just from the village nearby because the post they are tasked to work on doesn't require that much skill. They just need to listen to the translator's instruction, and the translator would go like, okay, now go dig now like take these soil out to blah, blah, something like that, really simple steps. And then for the more skilled labor, he would source these people from nearby cities, like the dump truck drivers would be hired from nearby city together with his vehicle. So basically the equipment and labor was mostly sourced locally at the beginning, and they were put on a monthly salary system. But then once these layers of Chinese firms downstream learned that the upper level financial progress was going really slow, and they start to feel it, because as a contractor, when you're working on the railway, you are supposed to just put in your money to fuel the construction and then get reimbursement based on the progress from your upper level SOEs. But what happened is that this reimbursement cycle gets kept missing. And then these laoban finally figure out that, okay, something is really going wrong on the finance side. Then they start tightening up their belt, trying to maintain construction with their own capital as long as possible. And it is from this point onward that they sort to deploy some extreme labor exploitation schemes, like delay or deny paying out wage to Lao labor, which quickly drive them out of the railway.
So the stage is set where the Export-Import Bank is going to do their $450 million of loan, but only if the Lao government puts in their amount of equity. But before the Ex-Im Bank's cash was even released, contractors, the SOEs already hired contractors, hired subcontractors who are already doing construction on the project. But then when the Lao government was found to not be able to put up their amount of equity that the Ex-Im Bank wanted to put the money out, then they were caught paying workers, building things without being... contractors were without being paid by the people who were contracting them. Am I correct in my assessment thus far?
Yes.
Okay. And so within this, at the end, it was the Lao laborers who got the most squeezed. And within your research, you looked into how Lao laborers sought to resist this exploitation of denied wage payment, and then how that turned into substituting Lao labor for Chinese labor. Can you go into that?
Yeah, sure. I wrote this paper like a couple of years ago, and it took a long time before it came out on a journal. Then after it gets published, I feel like I have a better idea to theorize and summarize what I find out, which is the term called disabled localization. Okay, so the small contractors on the ground, when they find out that there's upper level financial struggles and they're not certain when they could get paid according to the contracts, they are still feeling the pressure to keep the construction momentum going. This is because the unequal relationship that's already built into the articles in the railway contract, which basically mandates the subcontractors to first put in a deposit to the railway project company as an insurement, basically to say that I will complete the work on time with high quality, otherwise I will be losing the deposit. And that deposit alone costs 3-5% of the entire value of the contract. So if you get a contract of $1 million, then you're paying like $30,000 to $50,000 into the railway before you even started, right? And then you would be like jumpstart construction with your own money and then get reimbursements from the SOEs, as I already explained. And this cycle would continue on for several rounds until the subcontractors find out that it'll take long for them to get paid. Because on Chinese state-funded project, typically there is this culture of SOEs missing the first several round of reimbursement. And then they would usually use excuses of the financial mechanism hasn't been set up or whatsoever. And then the regular reimbursement cycle starts. But for the Trans-Laos Railway, it took a long, long time for this regular reimbursement cycle to get into action. So once the subcontractors learn this fact clearly, they are at a dilemma, in which On one hand, if they pull out from the railway at that very moment, it means that they are losing all the investment that they already put in, because the SOEs can easily accuse these subcontractors for not obliging to the contract terms and then refuse to pay any of the inputs they already invested. So a logical decision for these laobans to do was that they will continue fulfilling the contract with their own funding as long as possible and wait out for the upper level financial turmoil to resolve. So this was what a lot of people choose to do. And some of them do ended up in severe bankruptcy themselves because their funding, just their own capital, doesn't last that long. And what would happen in this kind of scenario is that the Laoban would really try to cut all the expenditures as much as possible. And that include cutting the payout for labor. So in the labor camp I worked in, 3-4 months into the construction, so the Lao labor stopped receiving wage after the first couple months. This is precisely the time the Laoban decided to shift his strategy, expenditure strategy. So what happened is that the Lao labor reacted really quickly to this situation of missed wage payments. Because they are, especially the low-skilled labor source from local community, they are really counting on the money to pay for the everyday necessities. So basically, as an employer in Laos, you can be missing payment to labor like that. So what happened is that these local laborers, they one day besieged the Laoban's office on a labor camp, and they demand to get paid there. And they just refuse to leave if they're not getting cash that day. So what happened is that the Laoban actually asked his secretary to run to the sort of small town nearby and borrow some cash from the contacts he knows there and come back to pay the labor. That's what happened. And this kind of situation repeated to happen until all the Lao labor just left the railway and they refused to come back out of the concern that the Chinese Laoban doesn't pay. And it is under these circumstances that the Chinese labor were brought in to work on the railway. And this newly joined Chinese labor was on a completely a different payment schedule. They are not getting a monthly paycheck. Instead, they are getting paid in a lump sum, like every 3 months, 6 months, or a year. Usually in this kind of arrangement, the Laoban would be paying the labor more at the end. But then it does give time for the Laoban to wait out the financial struggles on the railway and then keep the construction moving smoothly. So this is sort of a situation when the financial instability of a project disabled efforts of employment localization on the ground.
Super fascinating.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me is, I mean, this is the Trans-Lao Railway. That's, I mean, there isn't much more of a quintessential Belt and Road project than the Trans-Lao Railway. And so it's politically important. It's a major project deemed as a Belt and Road project. Still having this financial difficulty, although here it's because the Lao state didn't put in its equity. But at one point, you do mention how Beijing actually went and stepped in on this and to do something about the financial situation of the railway project. Can you tell us about what Beijing did and how the different SOEs to contractors, subcontractors reacted to it?
Mm-hmm, sure. So basically, when these financial struggles start trickling down, and then you get more discontent growing among Laobans, the SOEs was also like looking for the government to ask for money, because they are the one being sandwiched between the government and the low-level subcontractors. So at this point, basically, the railway's financial mechanism temporarily switched from a market-based one to Maoist kind of financial mechanism, which Beijing was kind of directly commanding these SOEs to use their own funding to finance the railway. So basically, it's asking these state-owned company allocate your fundings designated for other projects temporarily into the railway to solve this financial situation at the moment. And what happened is that the SOEs did move some funding around, but they are also unwilling to shoulder the burden. So what they did is that they tell the ground level subcontractors, look, this is the order we received from Beijing, which means that we are on the same side of the situation. We are all being exploited by this messy financial situation. So basically the SOE would ask, sort of force, coerce the Laoban skillfully to commit more of their funding into the project, and then sort of ask the Laoban to swallow their own bitterness and keep going with the construction.
It's crazy how much power the SOEs had in this whole equation. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I think the SOEs at the very end stood out to be like the only party that profited out of the project, because eventually the loan went through much of it. So what happened is that a lot of the construction are done by subcontractors that already pull out halfway. And these are the monies they don't need to pay anymore. So that's why they are like standing at an undefeatable situation, like in these state-funded projects.
Yeah, and so to just kind of wrap this story up, you say in your abstract that you call the Chinese counterparts, the Chinese laborers, more vulnerable. And you were saying that they get paid sometimes 6 months at a time, sometimes a year at a time. Where were these guys coming from? Are these some of the primary subjects that you were talking to in the labor camps? And where are they from? And talk about how they're actually more vulnerable than the Lao laborers. Because this is actually really parallel to what Ivan Francescini was talking about in Cambodia. It's really fascinating.
So I actually didn't talk to that much Chinese labor on the labor camp in like significantly lengthy and detailed interview because they were working. And so what happened is that I forged connection with them and had some like brief exchange. But then off the railway camp, sometimes they go into the cities to have break, or they have to go to the cities for hospital or other kind of renew documents or whatsoever. Then I would have a lengthy interview with them there. And some of the laborers are much open to talk about the exploitations on the labor camp after they quit their job. So that's kind of what it happened. And then, so for the vulnerability part, the Chinese labor, they accept the kind of wage arrangement of not getting paid monthly for a significant amount of time they work on the railway. They won't see any outcome, actual like cash repayment happening. They accept this kind of arrangement because it's a norm in China's domestic construction sector. So construction sector globally is a very complicated sector that involve actors owning each other debt. And so what happened on Trans-Laos Railway is just like a case of that. But this is not uncommon at all. So it's the same in China's domestic construction sector when contractors hiring labor to work on things, but they themselves don't get paid from the upper level developer of the project, something like that. So it's a similar dynamic that would foster this kind of labor regime and become really prevalent within China. So this idea of not getting paid until a year is not alien to Chinese labor in the first place. And then when they are brought into Laos and then stationed in a remote area where labor camp is usually put in, they depend everything on their employer. So basically, think about the situation when you even need to ask the Laoban to give you a ride to the bus station if you want to go back home to China, if you want to quit job. So how much does that afford you bargaining power on a labor camp? It really doesn't. So basically, the vulnerability is created by violent domestic experience in construction sectors, as well as the migration process, which strip away their bargaining power even further.
Right, and Chinese Laobans usually hold their passports too, right?
Yes. So Julia just mentioned the work of Ivan, who she and Eric interviewed earlier in the podcast, and I do engage with his work a lot. One pattern that we observed on mainland Southeast Asia regarding labor is that a lot of Chinese projects in this region particularly has a lower degree of localization as in labor sourcing. So this is in contrast to the situation in Africa, where I come across more works saying that more local laborers are involved in the construction sector alongside a small portion of Chinese labor. Like survey data that I just come across a few days ago says that this local labor's involvement in Chinese construction project in Africa is actually up to 85 to 90%. This is utterly not the situation in Southeast Asia. And I think this may have a lot to do with the fact that mainland Southeast Asia is closer with China. Hence, it's easier and cheaper logistically to source labor from China. But it may also have to do with the financial conditions of these projects. From my perspective, I think China's financial activities regarding BRI is a great leap forward for lending practice. And a lot of these lending practice is divorced from the fiscal reality of the borrowing state. So I suspect that a lot of these projects would have a difficulty in just the lending stage alone, as Trans-Laos Railway, the case already shows. So a lot of these projects may be built under similar condition of financial instability. So basically, you won't be able to have a stable financial flow, then you won't be able to pay labor on time. In this kind of scenario, it's impossible to use local labor.
Yeah. And this is kind of ballooned. I mean, Eric asked about kind of the bigger implications when Beijing stepped in. But now we're seeing under COVID that the Lao economy is kind of slowed down to the point of a trickle, right? And I think you and I have both talked about this in other cases or via social media. But there's been a recent story in which the Lao sovereign debt has been downgraded. And I think a lot of the people that you and I know in Vientiane who have been saying for a long time, like, oh, Chinese lending to Laos is getting it into a really dangerous position, are probably patting themselves on the back saying that they were right, just in the sense that there's been a few big developments in terms of Laos' sovereign debt becoming just far too unwieldy since the economy has kind of crashed in 2020. In, I think, the fall last year, news was coming out that Electricity du Laos, which is basically the Laos state-owned electricity grid, has come under so much financial stress that they've actually given majority stake of Electricity du Laos Transmission Company Limited to a Chinese firm. And so this has raised a huge number of questions about Laos sovereign debt. And yeah, how do you read that? What have you heard from your side about China's role in that? And how does this reflect back on questions that you raise about sovereign debt in your article and research?
So my reading of the case of EDL transferring shares of transmission line to a Chinese company is that this is a classic asset transfer. So I think the Chinese company receiving this transmission shares on these transmission lines have done construction works for EDL, but it didn't get paid. So in order to settle, as I told you, the construction sector is full of these case of people owning each other debts and stuff. So as the situation unravels, it's impossible. So EDL as a company has been in a really poor financial shape for a while. It was not caused by just COVID, although it's likely exacerbated by it. But it is owning a lot of companies' debt. And then I think for this particular transfer of transmission line asset, it's a kind of a barter system to settle part of the debt, which is nothing uncommon from my perspective.
Right. Right. But it's raised a lot of critiques of like, oh, see, this is what happens when poor countries like Laos can't repay their debts. A Chinese company takes over like the national power grid. So it's been a super iconic example, I think.
Yeah. But then, well, I think in situation when Laos cannot pay debt, it's likely that more asset will be given to Chinese companies. So now Laos is owning a lot of debt. It has to repay debt. What is the more like ideal way to repay these debts than transferring assets? So this asset transfer thing occurred not only to Chinese company, it has been occurring to a lot of Lao and foreign companies ever since early 2000s, when Lao kind of step up with developments, especially debt finance developments. So in cases when it's owning money to private company, sometimes it has to transfer even more valuable asset, like large amount of land. Laos as a country has dozens of special economic zone projects, and several one of them is directly connected to debt transfer. It's actually contractors who build infrastructure for Laos, like road, expressway, can get paid. So Lao government just laid out land for this company to settle the debt. And I think for the EDL's case, the national transmission grid that it passed on to the Chinese company does not have a clear profitable model for the Chinese company. So from an economic angle, this is not a good deal for the Chinese company. You know what I'm saying? Because as a transmission line, like how are you going to generate income from that? If you get a piece of land, you sell the liquidated land to collect profit. But right, for transmission exactly. line, it's a symbolic control of a part of Laos. But yeah. what does it mean?
Right. Yeah, this is a story I think that is still unfolding. I think, you know, the Laos sovereign debt rating was downgraded in September, I believe. And I think people are kind of waiting to see where things shake out over the next year.
So considering your approach and, you know, in your paper, you really spoke about how public debt and economic geographies have always been future oriented, which I found to be a really wonderful way of framing the idea of public debt and sovereign debt. So looking at it from this perspective and also your, you know, the ground up field work and the lived experience that you've had of people actually and people and companies and contractors carrying out projects in countries like Laos, how do you respond to the idea of the debt trap critique?
Well, thanks for the question. So I think I have a really clear and just one simple line of critique to talks about BRI debt. Is that we need to stop talking as if we are prepared, as if we know what's going to happen in the future, because that's really, you know, up open in the wild, especially when it comes to financial issues. Really need to be grounded in the present. And when certain kind of financial relation is unsustainable, like massive overlending to a country that ignores its fiscal capacity, it would have immediate effects in the implementation stage of project financed by that. And these effects are transient. If you don't try to capture these transient dynamics, as the railway is building right now, once it's done, you're never gonna know these hidden struggles. And they are super important to tell a BRI story that's not just about China exploiting vulnerable populations in other countries, but it's also about some Chinese actors, especially states and state-backed companies, exploiting the more vulnerable Chinese actors as well, like the subcontractors and the laborers. So it's as much a story about internal exploitation as a story of external exploitation.
I think that's a great point, the reflexivity, the kind of the connection between the two. Thanks, Kelly. Thank you so much for joining us today. Your work is endlessly fascinating to me, and I love chatting about it. Thank you for coming on the Belt and Road podcast. Can you stick around for recommendations?
Yeah, sure.
Great. You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast, where we bring you the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing impact on the developing world. And just a reminder to our listeners, feel free to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. Eric, let's start with you for recommendations. What do you have for us today?
All right. Well, this is maybe a first time. I don't know if we actually stated the paper at the beginning, but I actually I'm double recommending Kelly's paper, which we just spoke about, The Sovereign Debt in the Making, Financial Entanglements and Labor Politics Along the Belt and Road in Laos. It was in Economic Geography. It came out September 2020. One of the best papers that I've read on Belt and Road in 2020. So definitely, there's more details that we didn't cover in this podcast. So read it. It's great. And secondly, you know, I've basically been filling my COVID life quarantining at home with buying random consumer goods off of Facebook Marketplace in order to give me dopamine hits and keep things interesting. And Zoji Rushi stuff. Somehow I never knew about it. My wife introduced me to them. I got a hot water boiler that just keeps hot water 24 hours a day. It's incredible. And I never thought there'd be any difference between like a, you know, a $10 rice cooker and like a really nice one. And I got a used Zojirushi rice cooker. Oh my God. It's incredible, the rice that comes out of it. And so, and also it makes little songs and stuff. So anything made by Zojirushi.
That's amazing. That reminds me of my first year in China when I was like, how many different things can I cook in a rice cooker? Because it's literally the only thing in my kitchen. I was like, ooh, I can make cake. I can make it. Yeah, that's great. Kelly, what do you want to recommend for us?
I felt really sorry for Eric. You just find out how good a Japanese rice cooker can make rice.
I don't know. I don't know how I feel. Yeah.
I'm laughing so hard. So, I do have a huge recommendation. So I am based in Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, and the university has a Global China Center, which hosts a monthly talk. And I have to shout out for the next talk that's coming up on February the 18th. I know it's like just a few days after the Chinese New Year, but I think this one is worth everybody to attend because my favorite anthropologist in the world, Professor Xiang Biao from University of Oxford, who did amazing work on China's global migration, is going to be talking.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Wonderful. Yeah. And that's free to sign up, just
yeah, it's that. Open for public, and then you can find the link to register just by coming to Hong Kong University of Science and Technology's Global China Center, which you can find it under events. Of course, if you are my Twitter follower, I'll be tweeting about this event like from today on every day.
Well, follow Kelly on Twitter too. What's your Twitter handle?
Oh, my Twitter handle is Most Famous Kelly, unashamedly.
Wonderful.
The only problem is that this podcast might come out after his talk.
Oh,
so
then I'll just recommend this talk series, Global China Center's talk series.
Okay. All right. Great.
Yeah. And finally, Juliet, do you got any recommendations for our listeners today?
Yeah. So I wanted to recommend something by someone who I think Kelly and I are both fangirls of because we've been in a workshop with her, but Maria Repnikova, who is a political scientist who studies political communication in authoritarian states. She has an opinion piece that came out on January 15th called "No, the Chaos in America is Not a Gift to China and Russia." And I think she just has a very astute way of helping break down this idea that, you know, the U.S. political system is something that just like has a zero sum impact on China and Russia's struggles for global power. And I think she goes beyond the kind of discourses in geopolitics that I think are really adversarial. And I think she does a really good job of talking about propaganda and yeah, the US domestic climate and how it affects views in China and Russia. And so I really liked her opinion piece. And I also just wanted to say that we didn't have enough time to do this today, but Kelly and I did write a Panda Paw Dragon Claw blog post over a year ago now. And it talks a little bit about some of the on-the-ground views of Chinese investment. And it came out of a conversation Kelly and I had, multiple conversations on how there's different generations of Chinese migrants into Laos. There's an older generation and newer generation coming in, and they kind of facilitate each other. So check that out. We'll put the link in the show notes. And yeah, thank you guys. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Kelly.
Thank you.